Just want to welcome you. My name is Nancy Stevens, and I am the chair of the Mission Outreach Team for the Diocese. It's our privilege and pleasure to organize these talks, and held in the fall and in the winter session each year. I think this is the third cycle we've gone through. So today I'm pleased to introduce our speaker, Dr. Lois Mitchell, Director of International Studies at St. Stephen University. And she did her undergrad degree at UNB and a master's at Waterloo and her PhD at UNB. So kind of feels like you're one of us. And I would just like to say that from what I understand of Lois, having just met her today, but having read a little bit about her, that she challenges her students to think deeply about faith and justice, sustainability, globalization, and cross-cultural engagement. So we're very pleased to have her as our speaker today. The noon talk is, as the title says up there, Dialogue and Division in an Age of Political Correctness. And she will speak again this afternoon, 4:30 at UNB, Marshall Davery, room 261, on the topic of Christian response to climate change, a mixed bag. So you're welcome to go up for that as well. And there'll be time for questions at the end as well. So let's just invite Dr. Mitchell.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here, and I am originally from Fredericton, so it always is coming home when I come back to Fredericton. And I was pleased to have an invitation to speak today from Nancy back in the spring, and I think thanks to my friend Alan Sears for that opportunity to come and speak today. So one of the things I've really appreciated is that in preparing for today, I've sort of been kind of tracking some of my thoughts and trying to organize them. And this is a topic that I'm very, very interested in. So this has given me a chance to kind of pull some things together. And so I hope that it will kind of be appropriate for the kinds of things that you're experiencing in your lives and the things that you're thinking about perhaps as Christians. So a bit about who I am. I did grow up in Fredericton, lived here most of my life, did my undergrad and then my PhD here. In the course of my PhD, I got married to a fisherman on Deer Island, who's also here today, which was a bit of a departure from the normal academic route that might have been my future. So I've lived for the last 35 years on Deer Island. And I think in some ways that's really been a wonderful opportunity for me because it's actually grounded me quite well. I live a lot in my head. I think constantly. I can't shut my mind off, which is both a gift and sometimes a curse. But living on Deer Island, being very involved, our family's all fishermen. My husband, son-in-law are all fishermen. And so that kind of grounds me. But I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that because we have a limited time. So I want to start with telling you about a reprimand that I received probably close to 20 years ago now. And I had just started working for the Baptist Convention in the area of public witness and social concerns. And I had written a paper and quoted an author who I was reprimanded for. The person who was reprimanding me said, "You shouldn't even be reading this author, let alone quoting him in a paper." And so I think in some ways my journey in political correctness, I kind of track it back to that day. So I've gone on, I worked for many years with Canadian Baptists, both at the national level and in Atlantic Canada, working on issues of justice and public witness. As Nancy said, I teach at St. Stephen's University. I'm the Director of International Studies, and last fall I taught a course on power, politics, and identity. And in the course of doing that course and the reading that I was doing along with the course, I came across an author, a person whose work I was pretty impressed with. His name is Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. And it was an ideas episode from CBC that I listened to called The Politics of the Professoriate. And I'm going to come back and talk a bit more about Jonathan in a minute, but I'll just kind of whet your appetite by saying the thing that really struck me was Jonathan identifies as a liberal thinker, but said as a professor, he was very concerned about the kind of conversation and dialogue and the ideologies and the assumptions that are often made in the academy. He said he realized at one point that he hadn't had a serious conversation with someone who would consider themselves to be more conservative in their thinking for many years, hadn't had a single conversation. And so he goes on in this particular ideas episode to talk about the way that universities have always been a bit left-leaning, but they've become so much more left-leaning to the point now that it's hard to find conservative voices in the academy. And then he talks about some of the implications of that. And so this all kind of ties in for me with the politics of political correctness and all of the things that go with that. And then in this past spring, I had a bit of a Facebook dialogue, and I don't know if all of you are on Facebook and how much you pay attention to the quality of discussion and debate on Facebook. Every now and again, I think that there is a site, a Facebook group where it might be possible, but on this particular occasion, I had posted a link to something that I found really helpful and informative and got some pretty interesting pushback. And again, it was not because of the ideas that were presented, but because of the author and his political affiliations. So again, it's just like I thought, this is the very thing that concerns me, that we can't anymore talk about ideas because we're so busy locating where we are and where other people are relative to us on this spectrum of political correctness. So all of this to say that I've been navigating political correctness virtually everywhere that I am, in the classroom, as a citizen, in the church, even at home. Dale and I have somewhat to very different views on many things. We have lots of similar values, but very different views. So we're less politically correct, I would say. We don't have much trouble disagreeing and dialoguing and debating with one another. But in most contexts, it's a very significant and timely topic, I think, for us to be looking at. So what can you expect? I am incurably, I think, an optimist and also a generalist. Many years ago, I had a mentor in Fredericton. This is when I was here doing my PhD studies, Dr. J.E.P. Butler. And if any of you are historians, you may recognize his name. When I met him, which again was 37 or 8 years ago, he was 86 years old. I'd love to tell you stories about him, but I'm only going to tell you the one thing which is relevant for this. He loved to come up with these pithy sayings, and one of them was, everything is connected. He'd say, everything is connected. You can start anywhere and go anywhere. We'll never know all the connections, but we can know enough to get around. And that's always sort of been a great way to describe my understanding of how we think and how we learn. Everything's connected, and there are so many connections, we'll never know them all, but I just delight in finding connections that resonate and make sense. So that's kind of how I function. I was at a conference just a few weeks ago here in Fredericton, and the topic was teaching climate change in post-secondary institutions. And there was a lot of talk about imposter syndrome. And in that context, it was the idea that we might talk about our concerns for the environment and things we ought to be doing about it, but sometimes we don't feel we're actually living up to those things that we even believe we should do. I in some ways have imposter syndrome everywhere that I go, but the way that I deal with it is to acknowledge right up front that I have biases and blind spots. The blind spots, obviously, I'm not always aware of. The biases, I often am, and so I just like to declare at the beginning that I do have these things. I'm not an expert. In fact, I probably am a little bit suspicious of experts, because I'm such a generalist that I think experts often become so focused on a narrow subject matter that they miss many of the really informative connections that are just below the surface. So I'm not an expert, and I'm actually, I think that's the way I'm wired, but I'm actually quite happy to be in this position where I'm a generalist and I sort of look at life from a bit of a distance. But the one driving thing for me is that I think the pursuit of truth is both very important and life-giving, inspiring. I value science. I think science is wonderful. It's taught us, it's given us much. But I also am a bit of a skeptic, and I get concerned when we put so much confidence in science that we forget to ask the critical questions and to look at how political correctness even might impact our science. Science is not done for free. Science is funded, and the funding sources are generally two things, corporations or governments. So they bring into the scientific inquiry the very topics for which we can fund science, their own biases and blind spots. So I love to look at the scientific evidence, but then also look at whatever contrary evidence we can find. And finally, I would say I aspire to be kind, generous, accepting, loving, and I think that the pursuit of truth, along with those characteristics, should trump political correctness. And I know the use of the word trump, as in rises above, has a different ring these days. But anything that I say here today, I don't intend to offend anyone, but I do intend to speak as well as I can truth as I see it, recognizing my own biases and blind spots. So I'm not making an effort to be politically correct in what I say, and will probably try to catch myself when I'm doing that. Okay, so I don't know if you're comfortable with this, but I thought, what are some words or phrases that might come to mind when you hear the word political correctness? Anyone have any thoughts?
Inclusive.
Inclusive?
Non-judgmental.
Avoid all kinds of ideas.
Yep. Avoid conflict, avoid words that might stir conflict or hurt someone's feelings. Well, I will just put up some. These are a variety, and I don't know if they would all resonate, but politeness, fear, discrimination, racism, truth, fragility, extremes, rights, morality, justice, fairness, guilt, shame, binaries, oppression, tolerance, identity, language, equality, freedom, etc. So for me, these are some of the things that I think about when I hear the word political correctness. And it could be, oh, I was hoping today to experiment with just tell you quickly, there's an app that's called Poll Everywhere that would allow me to have you respond in real time to some questions, and then we would see the polling results on the screen. But there are two problems. The free version only allows for 25 respondents, so which might be okay because not everyone would have the technology in their pocket to do this. But the other thing is it seems a bit quirky, and I didn't want to spend too much time working out the technology. But it would, for example, create something like this, a word, whatever you call this. You know, and the more times people say a certain word, the bigger and bolder it is on the screen. So lots of things for political correctness. Of course, we need to talk about definitions. These are just two. One comes from the ever-reliable Wikipedia source, but it seemed to be the simplest one I could find. So political correctness, or PC for short, is used to describe language, policies, or measures that are intended to avoid offense or disadvantage to members of particular groups in society. And then from Encyclopedia Britannica, a term used to refer to language that seems intended to give the least amount of offense, especially when describing groups identified by external markers such as race, gender, culture, or sexual orientation. So this political correctness, it's as was said, not to give offense, to avoid using terms or language that gives offense, and especially to particular, often marginalized groups. So there was a survey done by the Angus Reid Institute in 2016. And so what I'm going to do is go through the questions quickly, and I'd encourage you to think about what your response would be to this survey. This is where we could have used the poll app. But think about what your response would be, and then we'll look at what the actual responses were. And it was a survey done in 2016 by Angus Reid of 1,510 adult Canadians. And then there was also one done in the U.S., and I'll show a little bit of a comparison just because it's so interesting, but we won't go into detail on that. So, which comes closer to you? There are only four questions, by the way, although one has four parts. Which comes closer to your own views, even if neither is exactly right? A, people need to be more careful about the language they use to avoid offending people with different backgrounds, or B, too many people are easily offended these days over the language others use. Okay, so just take a second to think about what your response to that is. Which one do you more closely agree with? Number two, thinking about your day-to-day life, how often, if at all, would you say you hold your tongue? That is, you choose not to say something you might otherwise have said because of the other people who are present. Often, sometimes, rarely, or never. Holding your tongue. Number three, and if you do sometimes or often, occasionally, hold your tongue, in these situations, which of the following is closer to your most frequent reason for doing so? Would you say, A, that you don't want to be judged for saying something that you might otherwise have said, or B, you just want to be polite? And question number four, would you say you agree or disagree with each of the following statements? People who complain about political correctness just resent that they can't say everything they want to anymore. Do you strongly agree, moderately agree, moderately disagree, or strongly disagree? It does occur to me we could have done standing responses for this, but anyway, perhaps not. The second question, agreeing or disagree, there are certain opinions you just shouldn't express in front of people you don't know. Strongly disagree, moderately agree, or strongly agree. And C, these days it seems you can't say anything without someone feeling offended. Again, strongly or moderately disagree, strongly or moderately agree. And the last one, would you say you agree or disagree that political correctness has gone too far? Again, strongly disagree, moderately disagree, moderately agree, or strongly agree. Okay, so the results of the Angus Reid survey. The first one is two-thirds of people think that too many people are easily offended these days over the language others use. Maybe I'll say if at any point there's something that really surprises you, feel free just to say, that does surprise me, because otherwise I'm just going to present them as they're given. And one-third, people need to be more careful about the language they use to avoid offending people with different backgrounds. Now, they broke this down. There's a lot more detail in the actual report, and I've just pulled out a few. But it's interesting that there are differences by age. Not surprising, but it's interesting. So in total, the rates are 67% to 33%. But they're slightly different, and you can see too many people are easily offended these days over the language others use is highest amongst the younger cohort, 18 to 34, goes down to 68 among those 35 to 54, and down a bit more for those 55 plus. Yeah, I guess you can see those. Okay, so a little bit of age difference. Political affiliation in Canada and the U.S. So the same question, but comparing the major political parties in Canada on your left. So Conservative Party of Canada, are more likely to say too many people are easily offended, 79%. The Liberal Party, 60%, and NDP, 62%. The differences are more pronounced and stronger in the U.S., where independents would be at 68%, and Republicans at 78%, and Democrats down to 37%. So some significant difference there. Agree or disagree, political correctness has gone too far. Agreeing with that statement, either moderately or strongly. Agreeing is 76% and disagreeing is 24%. So 3/4 of people in the poll believe that political correctness has gone too far. And again, there is some variation by age. This time, it's the goes up by age. So those that believe political correctness has gone too far, 82% of those 55 plus agreed with that statement, compared to 78% at the 35 to 54 cohort and 67% 18 to 34. People who complain about political correctness just resent they can't say everything they want to anymore. So if you lump together strongly agree and moderately agree, you have 57%, and moderately die. That's clearly a typo. meant to be moderately disagree, 32, strongly disagree, 11, so a total of 43 disagree. Thinking about your day-to-day life, how often, if at all, would you say you hold your tongue? Often, 17, sometimes 55, rarely 26, and never 3. We all may know one person who falls into that category. And when you hold your tongue, which of the following is closer to your most frequent reason for doing so? Those that don't want to be judged fell at 13, and wanting to be polite at 87%. That might be an interesting one to compare to U.S., but I don't have that figure here. But since politeness is a Canadian value, we're told, that may account for some of that. Yeah, so I think when I was searching for just the term political correctness, some of the graphics came up I thought were interesting. We condemn freedom of speech that hurts other people's feelings. And a lot is being said these days about the importance at all kinds of places, and I think of university campuses in particular, where you have to. Sometimes you're encouraged to, trigger warnings. If you're going to say something that somebody may find offensive, but you're still going to say it, then you might say, give a trigger warning to say, what I'm about to say may hurt someone's feelings or be offensive, but I'm going to say it. And some concern about that in a university setting. And I could go on and talk a lot about university settings, and I will talk more, I think, tonight when we talk about climate change and Christian responses, about eco-anxiety. And there's a lot of anxiety and depression amongst university-age students, and I think a lot of it may tie in very much to the mixed messages they're getting and the pressure and emphasis on not hurting people's feelings and being politically correct. I think this captures this well, politically correct area ahead, but note the barrenness of the land as you go further into the politically correct area. Is our intellectual landscape becoming barren? Have we stripped the soil of nutrients? If we're discouraging vigorous debate and discussion and having different points of view, are we actually stripping the soil of nutrients that are needed for intellectual thought and intellectual discussion? So a little bit more, I said I'd come back to Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan was born in 1963. He's an American social psychologist. He's looking especially at the psychology of morality and moral emotions. His work is fascinating. He's a professor of leadership at New York University. So he's the guy, remember I said, he considers himself to be a liberal thinker, but recognized that when he thinks about the people he has conversation with, he's actually not had a serious conversation with someone who's conservative in a long time. He has three major books. The Happiness Hypothesis was his first, which I have not read. The Righteous Mind and The Coddling of the American Mind. They all have long subtext to go with those titles. So I have read the last two. I find him fascinating. And again, the CBC Ideas episode, The Politics of the Professoriate, is very, very interesting. One of the things that I did want to mention in terms of that, He talks about the effect on academic research of the fact that the university has become so incredibly left-leaning. So he said initially there might be a 2-to-1 ratio, two liberal thinkers for every one conservative thinker. He said now it's hard to ever find a conservative thinker, and so the ratio is like 17-to-1 or 24-to-1. The result of that, from an academic point of view, first of all, not only are students not being exposed to rigorous and contrasting viewpoints in the classroom, presented in any kind of objective way, but the quality of research, he makes the point that if research is peer-reviewed, but all your peers have the same biases and blind spots that you have, then the quality of peer review research is actually in question. So this is a quote I think that's helpful. He says, morality binds and blinds. It binds us into teams. You know, there's this us versus them. We identify who's on our team and we're bound to them, but thereby makes us go blind to objective reality. We become so committed to our team, to the side that we're on, the side that most closely represents the way we think, and then we kind of shut off all the other voices and all the other ideas. I've thought of the pursuit of truth. I mentioned that's what inspires me. It's what gets me up every day. Like I love thinking and pursuing and experimenting with how different ideas combine. And as I said that, I just lost my train of thought. Okay, perhaps it will come back. I'm getting to be that age. Brandon O'Brien, this is a brand new book, just came out this year, and it's called Not From Around Here. And he's addressing this from the perspective of a Christian. But I thought this was just really helpful. He says, we are basing our most important decisions on beliefs about others that aren't founded in fact, but in spin and hearsay. We need an exercise in empathy. We need to find common cause, and we need to emphasize our shared identity in Christ over our divided identity as citizens of different parts of the country. I'm writing from the firm conviction that no one else will do it. It has to be the church. It's interesting, Brandon O'Brien grew up in rural United States. I forget which state he was from. And then he moved to New York, and he made a comment on Facebook or somewhere, and someone came right back and assumed, because he was from New York, that he would only be thinking in a very narrow range of topics and thoughts. So it didn't matter that he's not from New York and he didn't grow up in New York. And so he talks a lot, the title of the book, Not From Around Here, a number of these kind of experiences made him very sensitive to the fact that we often are just very quickly categorized and labeled, and then all kinds of assumptions are made about us. And I would say that anything coming out of the U.S. on this topic at this time, I'll get to a quote that will demonstrate what I would try very awkwardly to say about that. Going back again to that Facebook dialogue that I had this spring, this is the article from the New York Times that I had posted. It's called Our Culture of Contempt. And I thought I resonated so well with this statement. Political scientists have found, and again, this is out of the U.S., have found that our nation is more polarized than it has been at any time since the Civil War. 1 in 6 Americans has stopped talking to a family member or close friend because of the 2016 election. Millions of people organize their social lives and their news exposure along ideological lines to avoid people with opposing viewpoints. And I would say this is, very evident in the U.S., but I think the same, we're following in that same pattern in Canada, that same trend. He goes on to say, the average Republican and the average Democrat today suffer from a level of, this is a term he uses, motive attribution asymmetry that is comparable with that of Palestinians and Israelis. So motive attribution asymmetry is just this division of, there's only two streams and they're very asymmetrical. Each side thinks it is driven by benevolence, while the other is evil and motivated by hatred, and is therefore an enemy with whom one cannot negotiate or compromise. Just to give a quick illustration of this, there was an evangelist just last week on Deer Island for four-night evangelistic services. And from the southern U.S. state, I forget, Mississippi. And the sessions were excellent, but at one point, and it was a night that I wasn't there, but apparently at one point he made some reference to being a Trump supporter. And I think the atmosphere shifted. I mean, this is just an illustration of this. The atmosphere shifted. And in fact, he went from Deer Island to a neighboring community on the mainland, and a friend of ours said, you know, I really liked him, but I just can't even listen to him in the same way. Once I found out he's a Trump supporter, he couldn't even go. He just said, I just can't go. I can't listen. So I think that's an illustration of how much this is impacting us in our daily lives. Yeah. But to be fair, so that Dale had said that was a talk on the wharf, that the evangelist was a Trump supporter. But to be fair, we have a number of summer residents that come to Deer Island, and many of them are Trump supporters. And so those of us who are polite just don't talk much about American politics. And I'm, like right now, I'm assuming that none of you are Trump supporters. And so that's the whole thing. And I apologize to you if that's the case, that I think this is, it's frightening that it's coming to this, that we cannot talk to people that we fundamentally have disagreements with. People often say that our problem in America today is incivility or intolerance. This is incorrect, okay? This is the author of this Culture of Contempt article speaking. Motive attribution asymmetry leads to something far worse, contempt, which is a noxious brew of anger and disgust. And not just contempt for other people's ideas, but also for other people. Okay, so I put a link to this article on a Facebook group that I thought would be a good place to have some discussion about this, and got pushback right away. The pushback was not about the ideas, not about what he said in the article, but it was about who he is. Now, I confess, there are lots of people I probably should know who they are, and I don't. But I didn't know who the author was, and I didn't care who he was. I was reading this article from the New York Times, which I resonated with. So the author, I don't know, some of you probably know who he is, Arthur C. Brooks. How many of you would know who Arthur C. Brooks is? Oh, I feel much better already. Okay, so he's a public policy scholar. He was, up until July of this year, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank, and he had been president of this institute for a decade. Now, according to the person who responded to my post, this American Enterprise Institute, the whole discussion was deleted, so I couldn't fact check this, but the point he was making was he was affiliating him and this institute with the election of Donald Trump, that I think he more or less said this institute was responsible for getting Donald Trump elected. And therefore, again, ringing a, you know, sort of a reminder of I shouldn't even be reading this, let alone quoting it. So, you know, 20 years further down the road, and I'm still encountering that kind of mindset. So in July 2019, he finished as president of the American Enterprise Institute and joined the faculty of Harvard Business School. He's also an opinion writer for the Washington Post, described as a center-right independent. So that's where the Facebook dialogue, we did have a little bit of ongoing conversation because I said, you know, this demonstrates the very point that we can't talk about someone's ideas without bringing in all of the affiliations that person has and therefore judging them for those affiliations. So then I can't help think of some scripture that have always kind of resonated with me as well, Philippians 2, 3, and 4, just in contrast to some of the anxiety that comes out of political correctness. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others. And I think others and their ideas above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interest of the others. So what to do? You know, we live in a society, in a world where we're surrounded by these influences that push us in certain ways towards political correctness. Walter Brueggemann, who's one of my one of my favorite theologians. I only have a couple theologians that I know, it's not like of hundreds of theologians that I'm familiar with. He's one of my favorites. He's one of my favorites of like three. And they're all my favorites, my three favorite theologians. But he contrasts in this very short book, Journey to the Common Good, two different ways of seeing the world. And he talks about empire, which he says is based on scarcity and producing fear and anxiety. He goes all the way back to Joseph. You know, when Joseph was in Egypt and had a lot of responsibility in Egypt, and there was a famine coming, and Joseph set up this, he told the Pharaoh, it was the Pharaoh, right, that there was going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine, and Joseph set up this system in order for there to be food. But Brueggemann actually says, you know, we applaud that, but that was the beginning of this scarcity system and a scarcity mindset. You know, when there's a forecast of a bad storm, you know, people rush out to stock up on the essentials, and you know, we want to make sure that we're going to take care of ourselves. And it's based on fear and anxiety, the system of empire. And then Brueggemann contrasts that with the kingdom, which he says is based on abundance. And so he encourages us in this book to journey from empire to what he calls neighborliness. I'll give you a few, instead of trying to explain it, I'll give you a few quotes. The great crisis among us is a crisis of the common good, the sense of community solidarity that binds all in a common destiny, have and have nots, the rich and the poor. We face a crisis about the common good because there are powerful forces at work among us to resist the common good, to violate community solidarity, and to deny a common destiny. Mature people, at their best, are people who are committed to the common good that reaches beyond private interests, transcends sectarian commitments, and offers human solidarity. It is a trek that all serious human beings must make. One of the things that I did as I was preparing was I went back through, I used to write a blog when I worked for Canadian Baptist Ministries, and I went back through a couple of those, and a couple of them actually were talking about this book. So I just want to read a little portion of a blog that I wrote in 2012. Again, speaking about the book, Journey to the Common Good. In this book, Brueggemann argues that empire, that is secular society, operates on the basis of an anxiety system that is driven by fear and fueled by scarcity. This anxiety system is inimical to the common good. People, generally speaking, are so preoccupied with ensuring that their own needs are met now and into the future that they have no sense of broader responsibility to those outside their immediate sphere. It reminds me of the game of musical chairs we used to play when we were kids. People probably don't play musical chairs anymore because it probably hurts people's feelings. But we have an entire economy that is based on the principle of musical chairs. Anyway, our entire economic system is premised on the assumption of growth, more money, more products, more consumption. And like kids playing musical chairs, it's fun so long as you're still in the game. Not so much fun if you're the one left standing when the music stops. But is it an ethical system? Is it good for us? Is it the only option? Brueggemann believes that there is a system that is preferable. It's a system based on an economy of enough. The anxiety of the scarcity system is replaced with a whole different economy based on God's provision of what is needed. And, freed from the anxiety and fear of the scarcity system, people have time and energy to care for their neighbors. Thus, the community journeys from the anxiety system to an economy of enough to a state of neighborliness. What would happen if we changed our attitude and our habits so that rather than taking all we can get, we only took what we need? What would our world look like? What if we operated out of an economy of enough and resisted the fear tactics of a global economic system which profits from scarcity and convinces us We must use whatever political and military means necessary to make sure we get not just what we need, but what we desire. Anyway, these are the things I think about a lot. The power of the future, Walter Brueggemann says, lies not in the hands of those who believe in scarcity, but of those who trust God's abundance. Yeah, and a quick aside, because we're less than a week away from our federal election date, and because of all of the discussion, constant dialogue, constant commentary about politics these days, and just to borrow a bit of a segment from this afternoon's talk at supper time on climate change, you know, it's so easy for us to lament the state of the environment and to be concerned for the state of the environment, but at this very opportunity, when we get once every 4 years to vote for leaders of our country, I rarely, if ever, hear people addressing in public forums and in all kinds of opportunities to talk to the political leaders, things that would reflect more of a kingdom perspective, an economy of enough, and we're so easily drawn along with the rest of the country into being concerned about what is each party going to do for me personally or for my family. How are we going to protect what we believe is our right? So I think, yeah, as we think about these things from Christian perspectives, and going back to what Brandon O'Brien said, the church has an opportunity to be the ones that are thinking differently on these issues. And not only thinking differently, but acting differently. Anne Frank, this was written in Anne Frank's diary in 1944, and I believe about a month before she was captured and sent to a camp. What do you call those camps? Concentration camps, right. Okay, so she says, it's difficult in times like these, okay? So it's the war is well underway, and she's in living in a situation which could inspire a good deal of fear. She says, it's difficult in times like these. Ideals, dreams, and cherished hopes rise within us, only to be crushed by grim reality. It's a wonder I haven't abandoned all my ideals. They seem so absurd and impractical. Yet I cling to them because I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart. It's utterly impossible for me to build a life on a foundation of chaos, suffering, and death. I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder that one day will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions. And yet, when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better. That this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more. In the meantime, I must hold on to my ideals. Perhaps the day will come when I'll be able to realize them. And I just think, what a powerful kind of expression of optimism in the face of chaos. And, you know, this was a situation in 1944 for many people today. The context is different, but the feelings of despair, the wrestling with feelings of despair are very similar. Can't help thinking about Greta Thunberg, and I'll probably speak a bit more about Greta Thunberg this afternoon. But I think, you know, the one picture that really was compelling, I have quite a few mixed thoughts about Greta Thunberg, actually, but the one picture that was very compelling was the picture of her a year ago sitting by herself outside the Swedish parliament with her sign. But I think, boy, if I would pray for her and hope for her to be able to hold on to hope, you know, the kinds of things that she was saying to the United Nations, it is heartbreaking in many ways, to be a young person and have that much despair and lack of hope. I'm just going to put this slide up and not talk about it at all. Except to say, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship has this way of envisioning approaching differences. This is intended to be used in cross-cultural context, but I think it's appropriate when we think about how we interact with people who may have different views than we do. So I don't know how well you can make that out, but at the beginning, the personal entry posture, how we go into an interaction or a conversation or a relationship with someone who is different than we are, whether they're different culturally or different intellectually. So the green arrow represents openness, acceptance, trust, and adaptability, going in with a positive orientation and mindset. The red arrow represents suspicion, fear, superiority, and prejudice. So into that, we go into this cultural difference, which produces, the purple strip down says dissonance. So we go in and we have some dissonance because of the different views, the different culture. But because we're coming in with one or another view, it's going to make a difference how we come out. The dissonance produces frustration, misunderstanding, confusion, tension, embarrassment, maybe aggression. But as that all is going on, those of us who go into it with openness, acceptance, trust, and adaptability, our coping skills will be that we will observe, inquire, listen, and initiate. The result will be understanding, empathy, and deepening relationship. But if we come into those relationships, those encounters with suspicion, fear, sense of superiority, and prejudice, we will come out of the dissonance criticizing, rationalizing, and isolating, the result being alienation, withdrawal, and broken relationships. So as I think about where do we go, how do we deal with all of this, just a few concluding thoughts. Don't give up. As much sometimes as you just are tempted to withdraw into your own space, spend time with people that agree with you, resist that scarcity mindset. Resist the temptation to isolate yourself. Be determined to see people as they are and not as caricatures of someone on the other side of a deep and wide chasm. Have eyes to see and ears to hear. There's an Indigenous greeting, and I meant to figure this out before I came, but I forgot. One of the Indigenous languages, the greeting literally translated means, I see you, and the response is, I'm here to be seen. And it's one of those things, I heard this about 3 years ago, that was just one of those moments that's just consolidated so many thoughts, and it's become very informative for me since then. Really seeing people as they are, avoiding the caricatures, getting to know people. There's a TED Talk, I think it's just called Take the Other to Lunch, and it's a woman who said she was determined not to fall into the trap of political correctness and of being alienated from people that she disagreed with. So she got into the practice of finding someone who was the most unlike herself as she could find. And then they'd go to lunch and get to know each other and talk. And she said it's amazing how both, in the example she gave, they both concluded that they actually don't know anyone that is the caricature that we attribute to people on the other side. The fruit of the Spirit are compelling: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. As we feed these, all of the rest will be easier to do, to undertake. And Cherokee wisdom. One evening, a grandfather was teaching his young grandson about the internal battle that each person faces. There are two wolves struggling inside each of us, the old man said. One wolf is vengefulness, anger, resentment, self-pity, fear. The other wolf is compassion, faithfulness, hope, truth, love. The grandson sat thinking, then asked, "Which wolf wins, grandfather?" His grandfather replied, "The one you feed." And I think I'll stop there because I'm over time. But I think there is a little bit of time for questions or comments.
Yeah, time for questions. Speak up so that people can hear what you're asking.
Dr. Sears.
First of all, I thank you, and I want to thank you especially that you laid the responsibility on us in the church to think this way. We often portray ourselves as a big group of prayer.
Yeah.
My problem is I have two identities on. Mm-hmm. Right? And so in terms of the reviews, we're like, people are offended. Sometimes our problem is more than offend people. Mm-hmm. That is the greatest harm.
Thank you. I don't know how to quickly summarize that, but I do want to kind of make a comment because I think for Christians, these are really exciting times, but they're a bit perilous times as well. And even within sort of broadly defined sort of Christendom, even Western Christendom, I think the pressures of political correctness, the pressures of more liberal thinking, sometimes in trying to, I just think we have to navigate so very carefully, because sometimes in trying to deal with legitimate corrections and concerns that secular society may challenge the church with, that we may overshoot. You know, I think there's a danger of overshooting and going past the point of what the church has to offer and going too quickly to converge, like to bring our thinking into convergence with the secular society. And so I think there has never, well, no, that's it's probably overstating it. Well, I'm going to overstate it and then just say it's an overstatement. There probably has never been a time when it's more important for the church, for Christians, to reflect disciplined and discipline, I know that implies, I think finding and making sure the door doesn't close on perspectives that are consistent with the Bible broadly understood, like the spirit of the Bible and not just the letter of particular verses. Like those doors shut so fast. On issue after issue, we can just get swept along with culture, with secular society. And if we're, I have a friend and a colleague who'll say, you know, like, if we strip the cross of its offensiveness, then we've lost something vital to the Christian faith. The cross is an offense to some. I mean, and that's, if it wasn't, what would be the point of the sacrifice? So I think wrestling with these and talking about them in our churches or wherever we gather as Christians, I think are vitally important, and bringing the best minds that we can bring into wrestling with Scripture is so important. And I think we're constantly going to be learning as we push one another on those issues, and not to back away from that. All Scripture is useful for rebuke and correction. You know, if we avoid any kind of controversy, we're avoiding the very way that Scripture can help us to grow. And I always appreciate Alan's perspective on things. It's a bit like Dale that way. If I have an idea, Dale's the first one I talk to because he will not hesitate to show me its weaknesses and flaws. So it's great to get it out with him. Other questions or comments? Yeah. Yeah, so the comment is about groupthink and the danger of groupthink, which has led to all kinds of tragedy historically. You know, there's another expression that I find very helpful, and it's the expression is, we don't always act according to what we profess, but we always act according to what we believe. And so for me, I do think that's true. I think a lot of times we might go along with a party line or with groupthink. Yeah, maybe I'm saying something that contradicts what you're saying, although I completely agree with what you're saying, because groupthink often does lead people to not want to stand up, not want to take a position. But I think, like, sometimes we'll talk about climate change and how important it is to do differently, to live differently, and yet go on living the same way, you know? So, like, when we're honest with ourselves, I think that we're holding ourselves to account and wrestling with, what do we think? What do we profess? What do we think? What do we really believe? And Dale, there was an example you gave today about high school. Oh, I know, it was university students, and this was again in the U.S. But you know, this generation is supposed to be the most open-minded, the most accepting, the most tolerant, and it's just simply not true. So, on university campuses probably across North America, you know, there are students refusing to room with students who have a different political affiliation than they do. Yeah, it was an article in The Economist magazine. Yeah, about students who don't want to, if they're Republican, not wanting to room with someone who's a Democrat. The other thing that, in terms of that Republican-Democrat, and I forget where, this was maybe Brandon O'Brien's book, but, you know, there are a lot of Democrats in the U.S., a lot of Democrats. So, you know, if Democrats are unwelcome, let's say, on university campuses, then a lot of Democratic students are being silenced on campuses. I think he said, now it's dangerous when I quote figures, but a lot of people with different views are being silenced. And so I think calling some of that out gently, and not abrasively, but gently, I think is really important to give people freedom. Because increasingly, I remember being in Rwanda, you know, and one of those quotes compared the situation in the U.S. to Palestinian and Israeli conflict. When I was in Rwanda, you know, after the genocide, the law, it's illegal to express, even to talk about your ethnic background or to express any kind of hatred for people from another ethnicity. And good friends of mine who'd been there for 7 years said, you know, but none of that has gone away. It's just under the surface. And what happens in Rwanda, and I think in other African countries, as I understand, it's called third-party poisoning. And so if I disagree with you, but I'm not allowed to disagree with you publicly, then I might get a third person to poison you. And so it's fine. I didn't disagree with you. I didn't, you know, offend the law in that way. But it's just so under the surface. And I think the situation is in the U.S. and not as much so, but in the same direction in Canada. There are so many tensions just under the surface. And when people will stop going to listen to someone speak because of their affiliation, I mean, I think those are indications that things are getting very serious. And again, it is up to us as Christians, I think, to begin to step into that void and to model a different way to interact with people. Oh, yeah. Well, I can give a more recent example than that. I was at the conference a couple of weeks ago on teaching climate change. And as Alan said, you know, like, I'm at St. Stephen's University, which, if you're familiar with SSU, I mean, it has been a Christian university. It's a small public university, or sorry, small private university with a very deep Christian heritage, and I would say a very ongoing Christian community at its core. It was a small conference, there were only 30 of us there, and we introduced ourselves. And I may be overly sensitive, but usually I'm not, but I feel that just being in a more secular setting, but as a Christian, and then, so I made a couple of comments, and there was one person in particular that was pretty brutal. I mean, pretty brutal in his comments that in response to what I had said. And I confess, it really silenced me. I just thought, oh, I don't want to have this kind of conversation in a public. I don't want it to become, you know, I'm the victim and we're going to address this because you've hurt my feelings. So, but the alternative was just not to say anything, which was what I did. But I think there are limits, and I don't think falling into a victim mentality is helpful, but we have to find ways to kind of address those biases. It was interesting because there was another woman there who was from Mount Allison University and teaches religious studies, but her specialty is Buddhism. And her comments directly out of Buddhist doctrine and teaching were very welcome in a conversation about teaching about the environment. There are subtle forces at work, and I think we need to recognize them and find compelling, creative, peace-loving ways to address those things. And I think that will help people avoid groupthink and to take responsibility for our own actions. Yes. Oh, I could tell you, Marcus Borg. Marcus Borg. And it was the book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. And he said some amazing things about justice. And our, as I was speaking at that time to a Baptist audience, we, I think, have in some ways prioritized and separated evangelism from justice. We're doing much better now at bringing the two together, more so overseas, I would say, than in a Canadian context. Still in a Canadian context, we're a little bit head in the sand, in my opinion. Okay, well, I think that's probably time.